It is 27 minutes after the hour on a fair and felicitous Friday. And not Robbie Pruitt is not unheard of to appear on Fridays, but sometimes it's Wednesdays and... Well, that was sometimes it's Thursdays. Thursday is now the regular day, but you see, Robbie last week was marooned in Asheville, North Carolina, with shall we say, shaky internet.
That's right. Not a bad place to be marooned, and I guess I am a moving target lately. Thanks for having me on, Jim and David.
It's good to see you again. We missed you, and Asheville is a gorgeous, gorgeous place, but it's so crowded these days. There's a lot of people there. It's not like a quaint mountain town anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we were in Black Mountain at Ridgecrest, North Carolina, at that retreat center there. It used to be a Southern Baptist retreat center. Funny thing, I grew up going to that retreat center and remember it when I was my kid's age, but it's changed tremendously.
Well, the Anglicans moved in and took over, didn't they? No.
Yeah.
Or is it just a general convention center now? What is it?
Yeah, about 1,600 of us last week at the New Wineskins Conference, and another, I think, 400 online representing 60 countries. There were more bishops than you could shake a stick at.
Is this the annual event for Anglicans?
It is the largest North American Anglican missions. It might be the largest missions conference going for Anglicans, and it's every 3 years.
Okay. More bishops than you could shake a scepter at,
That's right. There were families there, a laity, clergy, deacons and priests and bishops and archbishops. Our archbishop was there, Archbishop Foley Beach, which is my boss's boss. My bishop was there. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, we were there for 5 days preserving Bible times, had a display table there, and we gave away helicopter flyovers to all the missionaries there, and so everybody could get a tour of the Holy Land for free if they had a DVD player.
Well, what happens there? Are there a bunch of vendors? Is like a convention, or is it maybe teaching seminars, or small groups, or all of the above, maybe?
All of that. Worship, Eucharist. I mean, the pinnacle of it was the Eucharistic service on Sunday, where we worship together. But missionaries from all over the world, they were Shade from Tanzania, working with people with albinism, was there, and missionaries were giving reports. Priceless, a organization that combats sex trafficking in Alaska, was there. And just everything in between, all kinds of missionaries. I went to a remissioning seminar on how to remission churches and how to help churches grow and survive when they're on the decline, to refocus and remission.
Well, that would be right up your alley with your new congregation, which is an old congregation, in fact, isn't it?
Absolutely. We've been around, Shepherd's Heart Anglican Church has been around for about 25 years, and we've been in our same location for about 15 years, founded under Harold Hammond, a Three Streams Anglican Church. And I've only been the rector there for 4 months, but we're looking at ways we can re-engage our community, reinvigorate our congregation, and refocus on the mission. Our mission statement is to walk with the wounded and equip the saints, and that's not too bad.
Excellent. Excellent statement. So, go ahead, David.
Robbie, did I tell you that I did a mystery shop one time for a church that was trying to repurpose?
A mystery shop. What would that be, David?
Well, I was assigned to go to a church service, and not identify myself as an undercover examiner.
And nice.
And then I went through the service and took a tour of the building, and then walked around, talked to some people, and then I went home and did a report.
Nice.
During the sermons, he had to go to the pastor's office and search his computer to see what was, make sure everything was copacetic there, you know?
Over the next couple of months, I got a number of phone calls from the people that were doing the report. And then they would file a report and repeat what I'd found and make suggestions about how the church could, well, and they weren't saying repurpose. They were saying, we'd like to get more members.
Yeah, remission is, focus on mission and what we're there in the community to do. So, but yeah, yesterday, I missed you guys, the Lamb Center in Fairfax, Virginia, a mission to people who are without homes, They called me in last minute for a Eucharist and needed somebody to come in. But that's a wonderful organization. But their chapel service is always Thursday morning. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm missing you guys occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's okay. It's worth giving up for a worthwhile purpose. So New Wineskins, does that give you a kind of a global view of what the Anglican Church is up to? And how big is the Anglican Church compared to other major denominations?
It's a great question. I mean, we're part of what's called the Global Anglican Futures Conference, GAFCON for short, and I attended in 2018 in Jerusalem, and there was about 2,000 bishops, archbishops, priests, deacons, and laity there, representing about 65 million Anglicans worldwide. In our case at New Wineskins, we had about 60 nations represented there. And bishops and archbishops and priests and deacons and laity, missionaries, and they were sending missionaries. They sent on Sunday morning, they sent out over 20 missionaries and commissioned them and prayed over them. Our archbishop, who has his roots in youth ministry through Young Life, actually called all the children and youth up onto the stage, and it's probably a couple hundred of them, and prayed over them and commissioned them to live out their faith and to live out the Great Commission in their lives, which was a beautiful thing. My nephew was there and was able to get prayed over, and it was really particularly meaningful for him. And he encountered, the place is just filled with God encounters. Mm-hmm. I mean, where you're learning from so many people, you're sharing, you're living together for upwards of a week. There was pre-conference and post-conference that my family and I didn't go to because we've got three kids in tow, you know, and other things to do. So we could not attend everything. But this conference happens every 3 years. So it happened right before the pandemic and right here in some of our
great. Great to hear about intergenerational activity there too, so that the oldsters are available to the youngsters and vice versa. That kind of thing is missing in so many churches, where the kids get to mix with the older folks and the mentors and the people who've been around and kind of guarantee longevity to the church. That's so important. You brought up the topics of Luke's. Well, we've been going through Luke for weeks here, and last time we were going to take a look at Luke 16, and I have a question for you. Luke 16 ends with the story of the rich man and Lazarus. And I want to talk literary context here for a second. This has all the earmarks to me of a parable. And among those earmarks, they don't name the rich man. It starts just like the parable earlier in the chapter. There was a rich man, you know. Mm. And so it's contrasts rich and poor, to be sure. Is it parable, or is it a real, actual, physical event that happened, historical?
Yeah, I mean, it is labeled in some passages as a parable. In some translations of the Bible, this is labeled as a parable, and that's where the confusion comes from, because as we talked about in weeks past, the chapter titles, chapter numbers, verse numbers, are not inspired word of God. These things were put in later by translators, and it can mislead us and misdivide. It can inappropriately divide the flow of the scriptures as we read them.
Well, NIV, it does not say parable,
right?
And which it does in the other parable. It says the parable of the shrewd manager at the beginning of 16. This just says the rich man and Lazarus. Now I know that's not inspired, but it leaves the context open to examination here.
Well, what it tells us is even the translators who are adding these titles to sections of scripture, adding the chapter numbers and the verse numbers, they did not feel comfortable labeling this as a parable. Mm-hmm. And that's telling, because they are labeling other things as parables, other passages as parables. So that is telling, and while that's not inspired, we believe that the people who are translating these passages are brilliant, and they know a thing or two about what they're doing. And so it is interesting that they choose not to label this as a parable. Also, there's nothing within the account that labels itself as a parable. So the teaching is there was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen, who feasted sumptuously every day. That's how the account begins in verse 19. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores. Not to be confused with John chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus. Yeah, this is a different Lazarus.
Is it Lazarus or Lazarus? This one is Lazarus, U.S. I hear the raising of Lazarus, the raising of, I hear that name pronounced two different ways. So that is confusing. Right.
But this is Lazarus, not to be confused with Lazarus, come out of the
grave. So Lazarus, come out, is E-T-H, Lazarus.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that's John 11. And that is, by the way, the other fun thing about this is the Lazarus account, of the raising of Lazarus in John 11, is a unique passage to John's gospel. Luke 16 and the rich man and Lazarus is also a unique passage to Luke. So we're talking about a very unique account that only Luke shares. Now, we know that Luke interviewed eyewitnesses. We don't know who he got this account from or why he includes it in his gospel, but it is a fascinating peek behind the curtain to eternity.
Well, it is, and it's kind of mystical, and that makes it highly unusual, because most either real historical events or even parables are pretty earthy, down-to-earth, literal happenings. This is a whole different category.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, it would be fascinating, too, to juxtapose this to Jesus descending into the dead to preach to those who were in the days of Noah. Mm-hmm. You find this in Peter. And so this acknowledgement that something's going on in 1 Peter 3:19, that Jesus descended. In the creed, it says he descended into the dead. He descended and preached to those who were in hell. So that's 1 Peter 3:18-20, but the account of the rich man and Lazarus begs the question, well, it appears that no one is able to transcend heaven or hell, or in this case, some people argue, because this is Abraham, we're dealing with Abraham in the narrative, that this is the bosom of Abraham, which is the Old Testament kind of holding place or place of the dead. So this is where Catholics tend to get the doctrine of purgatory, mm-hmm. this idea that there's a holding place or a holding room kind of suspended between heaven and hell. And so they get that from 1 Peter 3:18-20. But if this is indeed hell, the account in Luke, then there is no movement, so why would Jesus descend there in 1 Peter 3:18? It's a fascinating parallel when you start to put together, you know, a theology of death. And when you think about 1 Peter 3 is Jesus at his death pre-resurrection, and the rich man and Lazarus is told during Jesus' life, teaching, and ministry, before his death even. So does it make a difference if Jesus has already been crucified for our sins that he could then transcend and travel? Or is it because he's God that he can descend into this place?
I think you have to leave room for him to do anything he wants to do, including descend into hell. Don't put limits on him.
Right, and they say that, you know, anytime you ask a question of Jesus, you have to ask two questions of Jesus, because you're dealing with a 200% person, 100% man, 100% God. So, you know, as God, he can do whatever he wants, but then, you know, you get to C.S. Lewis's definition of hell, which is the absence of God. So if he descends to the dead, if he descends to hell, does it cease to be hell while he's present there is an interesting question.
Yeah. So by C.S. Lewis's definition, then, the absence of God is hell.
Yeah. And another passage that's interesting is to tie into this as you kind of think, and I'm not making any statements or you know, claiming where I am. I'm just trying to wrestle in the tension here.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to pull in Jonah and Jonah's poem in Jonah 2 of descending into the abyss and the seaweed wrapping around his neck. And he talks about almost being resurrected from a place of death or the abyss or the grave. And when Jesus is, they request a sign of Jesus, Rabbi, show us a sign. He says, I'm not going to give you any sign except for the prophet Jonah. As Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days, three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth. So Jonah is this type of Christ who descends to the abyss. And Jesus himself, at his crucifixion, death, and then burial, is now seen, according to 1 Peter 3, as having descended to the dead.
Hmm. So this focuses on Abraham, though, and it's Abraham's judgment toward the end of this, not I don't know what to call it, parable or literal event, either way. Abraham replies that if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead. Does this must presage Jesus? And this is coming from Jesus. He's giving us the words of Abraham, linking the Old and the New Testament again. Where's the marriage here?
Well, if indeed they will be convinced if someone rises from the dead, if Jesus descends to the bosom of Abraham, according to 1 Peter 3, and these people in the days of Noah who perish actually see him leave the place where they are and raise from the dead, will they then believe that Jesus is the Messiah and get a jailbreak?
Hmm.
That's a profound question. I mean, this is one, it's funny, I was in Bible college and we were studying 1 Peter 3, and we were talking about this subject, and I wanted to dive in, and my professor didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we're just not going to get into the weeds of this. And, you know, having taught a Bible class, I get it. We can't, you know, we're trying to cover things in a flyover, and we can't spend class time drilling down deep. But scholars have been wrestling with this for a very, very long time and have come up empty-handed. So here's the verse in 1 Peter 3. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. Notice it doesn't say hell there. In this translation, the ESV, but it says descended to proclaim to the spirits in prison. Now, as a Protestant, I'm not trying to, I don't believe in purgatory, a waiting room, at least not this side of the cross, the grave, and the resurrection. But there is such a thing as the place of the dead and Abraham's bosom. I think we're seeing it in Luke chapter 16. And then verse 20 of 1 Peter 3 says, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited for the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through water. And then Peter talks about baptism. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you, and not as the removal of dirt from the body, but an appeal to God for good conscience. And now, post-resurrection, we know that baptism, according to Paul in Romans, symbolizes our death, burial, and resurrection. As we go into the water and come out, I mean, it's Jonah all over again. We descend into the dead. We come out of the water to new life through resurrection in Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, which angels and authorities and powers having been subject to him. That's 1 Peter 3:22.
Let me throw a new angle at you. Jesus on the cross, a thief on either side, and he's going to meet one in paradise.
Right. Today, he said.
Yeah. Where is he talking about?
Right. And he certainly, I don't believe that the place of the dead or Abraham's bosom could be equated with paradise, though some could believe that that it is, and some do. Scholarship is divided. There's three or four ways to look at this if you read the commentaries. But again, if Jesus descends into the place of Abraham's bosom and he is present there, or if he descends to the place of the dead and he is present there, and the thief on the cross also goes there and Jesus is present, isn't Jesus's presence paradise? Again, to piggyback off of Lewis's definition of heaven being the presence of God and hell being the absence of God. But again, we're back to the 200% question, because if we're talking about Jesus as a human, he's dead and buried, and his body lay there dead. But as God, God doesn't die. Does God die? So isn't he still omnipresent as God, and therefore he is in paradise with the Father?
When I hear the word paradise, I read it in my English translation of the Bible, and I wonder what it is. My first impulse, if I were a student of Greek, would be to go find out what the Greek word really means, because so many words in Greek have different shades of meaning, much like they do in English. But I'm wondering if our notion of what paradise is, we use it as a word that means a happy, wonderful, almost as close to heaven. Maybe the original intent of that word was something else entirely.
Yeah. And then juxtapose all of what we're talking about here today with Paul's words in Corinthians, where Paul says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So, as followers of God, when we die, we don't believe that we're in some holding place absent of God. We believe that absent from the body is to be present with God immediately. At least that's my eschatology. And again, when does this take place in history? Is it because Jesus hasn't come incarnate, lived a perfect life, sinless life, died a sinner's death, was buried 3 days, rose again according to the scriptures, and now absent from the body is to be present with the Lord? And before that, you have a place of the dead, a holding place. Abraham's bosom, is that heaven? Or is heaven not yet, and we've got to get past the cross and the resurrection to free those folks? Is what Peter is talking about in 1 Peter 3 the same as Abraham's bosom, when in the days of Noah, Abraham doesn't exist yet? I mean, so really, we've got to think of this chronologically, and how does one thing affect the other?
Yeah.
And I'm glad that in the end, Jesus will be able to answer all these questions for us.
I'm going to have a few for him, that's for sure. But fortunately, in my faith, it really doesn't make any difference, because what's going to happen is going to happen, you know? Pastor Robbie Pruitt, an Anglican, is a priest. Like, we refer to him as Reverend or as Pastor, but he's a priest, and his church is in, he lives in Ashburn, Virginia. The church is in Fairfax, Virginia. And he is the high mucky muck, the grand poobah, the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, which is a wonderful ministry. You can link to it from our site. Yeah. PreservingBibleTimes.org, and there is a wealth of contextual information that will help you understand what you're reading when you go through Luke or any other chapter, particularly the New Testament and the four Gospels. You want to be familiar with it. PreservingBibleTimes.org. There's free stuff there. There's books that are e-books, as well as streaming video. You'll find it a very rewarding place to visit. PreservingBibleTimes.org. Robbie, thanks so much. We'll look forward to next week.
Hey, I enjoyed wading through the weeds with you, gentlemen. Thanks so much for having me on.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Shoo.